accession number 18475, reel 3.
Arnold Baldwin, reel 3.
So I said, well, if I'm not a trained soldier now, when am I likely to be? And of course he couldn't give a much of an answer to that. Well, about 2 weeks later, another order went up saying that volunteers were required for training as glider pilots. And all applicants must be accepted. All applications must be accepted. So I thought, this is my out. So I went back again to see the CO. And within a short time, I went to Oxford. What did they call those? Air Crew Selection Board, I think was the term. So I went to this Air Crew Air Crew Selection Board in Oxford, and we were given a very rigid, as all air crew were, a very rigid physical test, a reasonable written paper to complete. I remember, and if you got through what were really a fairly limited educational requirement, and you were fit, they gave you certain tests. For instance, they had a gadget there where you sat in what would be a cockpit. There was a screen there and two lines, vertical and horizontal lines, bisecting the screen, and a little pinpoint of light would appear behind this thing. You had a joystick, if you like, and you had rudder pedals. And this point of light in the screen would wander about all over the place. And with the use of the stick and the rudder pedals, you had to keep it centralized as well as you could in the center where the lines intersected. Which was a reasonable test of coordination of eye, hand and foot, I suppose. And I passed that one all right. Well, anyway, I did pass through that. And there was also an interview to go through as well, in which there were two RAF officers. And in this case, there was one man wearing glider pilot's wings, so an army man. Well, while the RAF officers ask you sensible questions as to education and your general attitude to life and things of that sort, the army officer, of course, was more on the side for bull. And I thought it was very amusing because one of the things he said was, well, if you are, you do become a glider pilot, what do you think you'd have to do? So I said, well, I should imagine you'd carry troops over into Europe and land them behind the enemy lines to attack them from the rear. So he said, yes, and then what would you do? So I said, well, I could have made a sarcastic remark and say, well, I don't think I can catch the first bus home. But so I said to him, well, you'd have to obviously stay and fight with the people you carried over. It seems to me to be the only alternative, the only thing you could do. All right, that was okay. I then went down to Tilshead, I suppose, in all your interviews you've heard of Tilshead. and from there on, I just went through the normal army bull at Till's Head, EFTS, glider training school, and finally heavy glider training school. And
how did you get on with the training?
What, the flying training?
Yes.
Well, I got oh, my logbooks are over there. I got two averages. The first one at EFTS, the elementary flying training, I got
average.
And the final one, as a heavy glider pilot, I got above average. Anyway, the three were good enough to get me through. And from there on...
What did you feel about the quality of the training that you received?
Oh, by the ref?
Yes.
Oh, admirable. In fact, I think at this stage it's as well to pay a tribute to the RAF, because without the RAF there could never have been a glider pilot regiment anyway. The army in those days had no airfields, no planes, no instructors, no maintenance fitters and so on. We had nothing. And in fact, throughout the Second World War, we had nothing without the RAF. They gave us our flying training in the first place. They provided the aircraft, and they provided the maintenance people for it. They provided the tugs for the gliders. They provided everything. So, as I say, without the RAF, there'd have been no glider pilot regiment. It was... this book rather illustrates the point. It's by a wing commander named Wood, by the way, and...
It's called A Noble Pair of Brothers,
yes.
A History of Number 38 Group,
yes.
By Wing Commander D.H. Wood, RAF.
But as you see, the illustration on the cover is of a tug and a glider, and that's what he means by a noble pair of brothers. Because 38 Group was the RAF group that carried out, from the Air Force side, all airborne activities.
So which squadron of the glider pilot regiment did you go into when you were trained?
Well, there were no squadrons when I joined. They hadn't really got that far. They'd had what they called the 1st Battalion. They'd taken a certain number, had gone through, and I went for training just as that first lot had passed out, and they'd got shipped out to North Africa. And that was called the 1st Battalion to start with. And I was in at the beginning of what was then known as the 2nd Battalion, who were posted to various aerodromes in England after training. Then, a bit later, we began to form into squadrons, so that the 2nd Battalion, as it were, started forming squadrons here in England. And if I've read my own notes... Oh, you've got my notes.
Yes, I've got them. You said here that you were in B Squadron under Major Turler.
That's right. Yes. And I was with Major Turler throughout the war. And I last saw Major Turler about 3 weeks ago, or a month possibly now, at Middle Wallop, where the present Army Air Corps have their headquarters. They're the fellows that fly the helicopters. And they are a totally independent force now. They've their own airfields, their own aircraft, their own maintenance, everything there self-contained as a flying unit, which we never were.
Can you take me through the preparations for D-Day now? What preparations did you make for the D-Day landings?
Well, certain tasks were given to different squadrons. I don't know how many other squadrons had tasks similar to some of the tasks that B Squadron had, but one of them was to land on the bridges on the Caen Canal and the River Orne. I think three of our crews were selected for that job. And another of the tasks was to land inside the Merville Battery, just inside the coastline at Normandy. Three crews were selected for that, of whom I was one. The organisation up to that point was pretty fantastic. We had training films to look at. The actual battery site was photographed by low-flying mosquitoes. They brought back films of this that were screened, and we could see how it was when you approach the coast and the layout of the land and so on. The army then constructed a similar setup near Newbury. And the Paras, it was the 9th Battalion of the Parachute Regiment that was to do the Merville Battery, although several other battalions were involved in the D-Day landings, of course, but the one that I was connected with was the 9th Battalion under Colonel Otway. And we were given the task of landing three gliders inside the battery enclosure, as it were. And the main force of the battalion were to make their parachute drop outside and attack the battery from outside, while our aim was to destroy the guns immediately from inside the battery. Well, because it was considered to be something a bit more than normal airborne infantry would be asked to do, the three gliders carried parachutists as well, not ordinary, what were called air landing troops, who were not volunteers anyway. It was a question of certain battalions in certain infantry regiments were told that they were air landing troops, and that was it. And they were conveyed by glider, mostly. But these chaps were, as I say, on their toes and very, very keen types as well, all volunteers, as were our regiment. And we trained together, mostly the main body of the 9th Battalion would be training down near Newbury, attacking this mock battery that had been constructed there. Those of us who were doing the battery, the three crews to do the battery, were practicing night landings at Bryce Norton, which was our base, by putting out some flares three flares forming, because the site where we had to land was roughly triangular, and so you had an apex one and two base flares, paraffin flares, and you would practice at night to land three gliders within this enclosed space, which I think in my account there I said was quite easy at Bry's. Different matter, of course, when under different circumstances. And so we trained at that. The chaps doing the Orne bridges and so on, I don't know just how they trained, but they must have had a similar form of training. And in fact, I've got a video that was made by our regimental association some years ago, and they reconstructed this business of the pilots doing the bridges, showing how they made their approach to the landing zone and everything. It's a brilliant piece of work. There were at least one glider load. The pilots were long-time friends of mine. We'd done all our training together right from our first induction into the regiment. I knew them quite well. I think that's about it as far as our training was concerned.
Can you take me through the actual operation, step by step in detail, please?
Well, in my case, I'm sorry to say that the operation was a fiasco. All the months of very careful training that we'd had, plus all the detailed planning that we got, for instance, the mosquitoes photography and this sort of thing, was absolutely brilliantly organised. But when it came to the three gliders themselves to do the battery job, I'm afraid the RAF rather let the side down there. Things fell to pieces, rather. The idea was that the gliders had to have parachutes, arrestor chutes in the tail, so that they could be landed in a very short landing run. Also, they were equipped with a very crude form of radar, which existed then, known as Eureka and Rebecca. And it consisted of parachutists would have to go down and put, what would be the word for it?
Transmitter?
Yes, it would be a transmitter, yes, giving a signal. And this signal would be picked up by a unit fitted in the glider for the glider pilot to home in on this light, this beam. And so the gliders that were to be used, I don't know too much about the bridges, what they did with those. A very similar thing, I think. But in the case of the Merville battery, I'm sorry, can you stop it? Yes, please. While the training that I've just referred to, the landing, practicing landing within this small space, was being carried out by the first pilots of each crew, the second pilots who would be on the operation had gone off to Netheravon, I think, to train themselves in the use of Eureka Rebecca, so that we had spare pilots with us when we were doing our night landing practice. Well, then when the aircraft arrived, when the three hoses for the battery job arrived at Bryce Norton, it was found that they'd put the Rebecca in one set of three and the tail parachutes in another set of three, so that that was the first mess up, really. They then had to, one way or another, equip. The easiest way, and I don't know why they didn't do it, was to take either the tail chutes or the Rebecca Eureka from one of these set of three gliders and transfer it to the other set. But instead of this, they scouted round at the MU, the maintenance unit at Netherhaven, for three more gliders to put both lots in. Well, gliders were pretty thin on the ground by then, because earlier, I think in May, there'd been a very big night flying exercise, obviously in preparation for D-Day, in which I think almost 100 gliders were up at the same time and had to make a mass landing, nighttime mass landing at Netherhaven, where it's a huge field and it had been divided up into different sectors, and the gliders were given their landing zones on that aerodrome. Unfortunately, that exercise, which took place, I think, not much more than my logbooks would give the dates, was a terrible mess up. The gliders were released. An error was made in the first place by the lights that were to shine, searchlights, I think, were up. But they were put in the wrong places by the paras who went in to give us the guides. And they put them in wrongly. This was on the practice at Netherhaven. And the gliders were coming in head on towards each other from at least three different approaches. So I was lucky there in the fact that I knew Netherhaven fairly well. And there was one small, not much more than a paddock in one corner of the aerodrome. And I could foresee a lot of this was going to be a bit of a shambles. And I said to my co-pilot, I said, they can stuff that landing zone we've been given, Joe. I said, we'll go in. I know where to land, and I think it will be fairly quiet there. So I did go in to land there, but it wasn't all that quiet, because other aircraft came in, and they were tearing the wings off each other, even in the small place I went to. But the net result of this exercise was that a hell of a lot of gliders were smashed and useless. And this is just about 3 weeks before D-Day. So that, and they would have been, in the main, some of the better gliders, the more recent ones. As it was, when they went to get three gliders now to make up our three for the Merville battery job, they got two that were decent gliders, and one that had been hanging about on Netherhaven, I expect, for a long time, and it was a very old one, and it looked it. And when it came to the flying, it flew like it as well. When we saw these three, of course, Sal Major was a bit put out, like all of us were, especially as our colonel commanding our battalion had said that it'd give us the three finest gliders in the regiment. Well, it didn't work out like that. We just drew straws, and I'm afraid I got the Duff one, which proved to be a disaster for me. It certainly was.
What actually happened on D-Day itself, too?
Well, on D-Day itself, a number of things seemed to go wrong. In the first place, we had never carried quite as many troops as we were then to carry. I didn't know just how many people were going to go on my glider. And when we were loading up, I was counting them aboard, and 30 blokes went on board. I thought, my God, that's a heavy load. As well as that, each man was carrying a spare haversack, small haversack. Got one on his back in the usual way, and he was carrying a spare one. And I said, what's in those spare ones you've got there? And they said, grenades. Well, I thought the weight that we're going to have on this glider is unbelievable. I don't know how we're going to do this. Anyway, I felt that I couldn't protest about it to anyone. It was too late. We'd got our takeoff time and everything, and here we were loading up. It's too late to say, well, we can't take this and we can't take that. So I just kept my mouth shut and hoped for the best. When we got onto the runway for takeoff, my tug pilot was my regular tug pilot and a first class bloke. I think they all were anyway, but I thought he was exceptionally good. He started to move down the runway, and of course I moved after him. And after the usual amount of runway had been taken up, I tried to lift her off, and I got absolutely no response to the stick at all. And presently I got frantic calls. We had in the tow rope linking the tug and the glider was telephone cable, so that we could speak to each other through this cable. But I think the great strain imposed on the rope because of the load in the glider had either strained beyond the limit or broken even the telephone cable. So I couldn't really, at first I could speak to him, because he said to me, when are you going to lift her? Because a glider always had to get off the ground before the tug. Otherwise, if it didn't, the tug could never get off the ground. You had to get up a bit above the tug to let the tug get off itself. At that stage, I'd still got communication, and I got a frantic call from Dennis, my tug pilot, to say, when are you going to lift off? And I said, I'm trying to, Dennis, but I can't get it off.